This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, climate change and its impact on your physical and mental health. But we are going to start with how our brains can be wired differently and how that impacts our physical and mental health and well-being. We have two guests in studio. They are the co-hosts of the web series and podcast, Where Are You From? John David Birdall and Heather Zinger. Birdall says he picked that title because it's a question that he got asked all the time, but realized that's not really what people wanted to know.
Because I come off really, quirky, unconventional, as we're going to talk about atypical. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they're just not used to it. And so they just kind of look me over. You know, they kind of size me up. And it's like, so where are you from? You know, and that's what I get asked. And I do answer. I take it literally because I'm, you know, wired to be very, very literal. And then I answer, you know, I'm from Fargo, Moorhead, or, you know, I'm just from a couple blocks away.
Sure.
And they're not satisfied with that answer. You know, and that's when they weren't being satisfied by that answer. And that's when I really started to like look at, why am I being asked this? You know, and so often where I live, you know.
Yeah. And you just said, because I'm wired to be literal. Yeah. So what we're talking about is some brain wiring right now. Because you have Asperger's syndrome.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so that is what people are really getting at when they're saying, where are you from? Mm-hmm. In the podcast, you have this clip that it's really, why are you so different from me?
Yes. Yes. But they don't know how to ask that, you know, in such a way that, you know, without perhaps, I don't know, aggravating or agitating or, I don't know, of maybe eliciting some sort of response that would be uncomfortable or, you know, I don't really know. I don't really think about it too much. I hadn't really thought about it too much.
Okay.
Like how difficult it could be for some people to try and find out why someone is different from them. It doesn't even like occur to me now. I'm talking about it now, but I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to say. I don't know how I'm supposed to say this. You know, often I'm very articulate.
But sure.
Like, I don't.
But
I'm
just
me. I'm out of my area when I'm there, you know, or trying to think like that. And so I did in an episode, finally just try and answer that question.
Yeah.
You know, why am I so different from you? And yeah, I'm on the spectrum, you know, and I interpret sensory input. I interpret the world, you know, in a very different way. In a very unique way.
Well, let's talk about that sensory input. How is it that you describe how you are processing all the information that comes at us in a way that sets you apart from other people?
Okay. Well, so how I do describe it to some people is that yeah, I'm a stranger in a strange land. I'm going from kind of general and I'll go to specific. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So stranger in a strange land or a foreigner, you know, in your country. I don't know all your customs and I don't know all your, you know, what some words that you're saying. And that just happens with people, you know, people trying to communicate, you know, or talk to people or whatnot. But yeah, as I get to now specific, it's like certain sarcasm even now, it's like I don't like it, just looks so bizarre to me. You know, or if a person is smiling while crying, you know, it's like I'm doing it right now, it's like I don't understand what I'm seeing, even though logically or perhaps intellectually I've had it explained to me intrinsically. You know, it's like this is not making any sense whatsoever. Like, yeah, I'm getting nods in the room. So it's like, this is really, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for acknowledging that. That's really nice of you. Because some people just will say, will you just be quiet when I'm trying to ascertain what's going on? You know, and I'm not calling those people mean, but, you know, it's like I'll try and ask, like, so what does that mean that this person is crying and smiling? You know, is the person sad or is the person happy?
Right.
You know, and so I'm attempting to, discern and interpret all of that kind of dissonance.
Yeah.
You know? And I've put in the work now. I was diagnosed at 30. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. So I spent 3 decades in another dimension. That's what I tell people. And again, to be specific, it's like all of this is happening, but not one person had sat me down and explained why it was happening. You know?
Right.
And they didn't know that they were supposed to. They just presumed I would get it, you mm-hmm. know, like perhaps typical people do. It's just like, well, this is school because it is school. You know? I'll just be here, but I don't. And so academically, I did really well because I was told to. So
oh, sure. Yeah. Well, and people with Asperger's tend to have higher than normal IQs as
yes.
well. It's more so the emotional intelligence and those cues that has a different processing speed.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And it's a bit slower.
It sounds exhausting.
It can be. It can be. But since this has been my world, I coped with it and got acclimated to it and got used to it. And now we had been talking. It's like, and so now it's my superpower to really figure out what's going on. And I have a really associative and connective mind, you know, and I can see, you know, pieces. I can see everything that's going on and I start to put it together, you know, in a way that's supposed to make sense to me. And then often when I do that, people will say, wow, that really makes sense to me. You know, it's like that makes better sense to me the way you put this together.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean a web series. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like just putting together a web series. I just did it because I was getting asked all the time, where are you from? So I was
right.
like, I'll just put together.
I'm going to make this easy.
I'll just answer the question that way. And it's like, and people are like, this is phenomenal. And I'm like, well, that's great. Because I don't have that relationship to my feelings that other people do. It's called alexithymia, to be specific, really, really specific. And I don't have a concrete sense of self. I don't know what emotional state I'm in. You know? Being alive, you know, just being here. And
conversation we're having on the way over here is John's driving, right? So we all know we're a little bit more focused when we're driving, as we should be.
Sure.
And we were having this conversation. I can't remember all the things. I'm not going to go into that unless you want to, John.
But I can remember it, and I have an eidetic memory.
Yeah. Right, and this is mine. My memory is not great. My working memory is also a function of the ADHD. That is not wonderful and something I have to adapt to. But I saw and experienced a little bit more intensity. So stronger speech, maybe a slight rise in the voice, all this stuff. And I'm watching that, and for me, this means something. But I was like, wait a minute, John, I'm observing this, but I don't really know if what I'm observing and what I think that means is matching your experience. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this.
Sure.
And what was your response?
I was just giving what I was getting. I was mirroring. Like, so, and not to say, I'm not responsible for any of my behavior. It's like now I know that when I'm around certain people, like even in this room right now, I realize I'm speaking softer. Because we're all speaking softer. I'm just doing it, you know.
Okay.
And I have enough, and I had called it intentional focus, to know, oh, that's why I'm doing that. You know what? I'll keep doing it, you know, because, you know, the group is doing it, you know. And so that's what was going on in the vehicle. She was – you had admitted you were sort of nervous, you know. And it's like
– oh, because we have – I mean, we talk about a lot of things.
Sure.
But I was like, let's just check in about this real quick.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And then we talked about there being skills, like real skills that you, when you say that you're intentional in how you're doing some of this mirroring, was skills learned.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Like noting that something is going on, you know,
mm-hmm.
I can talk about that. And then really allowing something to continue, but also, listening to paying attention to nonverbals, you know, and also verbals, you know, hearing how another person is feeling. And then, I'm driving, but also, you know, it's kind of like, okay, there are a lot of gestures. I notice that with people. It's like, I have to do that. That's the work that I have to do you know, the focus that I have to have. I have to just kind of look at a person and study. And as I had said, if a person is crying and smiling or, I don't know, being physically sort of like really, really animated, but saying, no, I'm perfectly calm. It's like,
it's fine. It's fine. It's just on fire.
Exactly. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm out of my element here. You know, and I start to admit that to people.
Yeah.
I do not understand what's going on right now. You know, I don't get this.
And I have to step back.
I suppose so. Although for me, I just walk into the storm.
Oh.
Because that's how I found not having a sense of self, and I do hope, Heather, that you can talk quite a bit. Isn't it great how not having a personality monopolizes or like takes total totally like hijacks a conversation. You know? Oh, really? You don't? You don't have like a tell me about that for hours. You know.
And I think what's interesting is we've already had a lot of this conversation of like your experience in that way.
Sure.
And that's why I love that you started this web series, is so that other people can be part of that conversation. And so when you watch the web series, it really, you know, the first season is John going through and laying some ground. And, you know, you're getting this big introduction to John. And then we could talk about how I came to be a part of your web series quick if you want to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, Heather, I want to play a clip because you come in season two of the Where Are You From podcast, and we are visiting with the co-hosts of that program, John David Berdahl and Heather Zinger. And Heather, in this clip, you are really frustrated about banging on the table one. Yeah, about going through life with the neurodivergent brains that you have in a world that is neurotypical. And we're going to talk more about what that means, but I want to establish a little bit more what that feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And can we just take a moment to be like, okay, we both have diagnoses, we both have done our work, we both continue to do our work, and yet sometimes when it comes to certain neurotypicals, it's like, are you f***ing kidding? You could do some work. You could, and you need to. Stop making it hard.
Now, we're all laughing at this, and Heather, I've known you for a few years, and we have had several conversations about the work that you have put in to what it means to be Heather Zinger. And how I came across this interview idea is you had posted it on Facebook about joining this web series on being neurodivergent in a neurotypical world.
Mm-hmm.
What is neurodiversity?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. Thank you for bringing that up, is to really, how are we going to frame this conversation that John and I are now having together?
Mm-hmm.
John coming from an autistic perspective, I coming from an ADHD perspective.
Mm.
And so I was going online to do research just because I'm like, you know, we can talk about it from our experience, but I want it to be a lot more like literal and articulate, which is not always my my forte. But basically when people talk about neurodiversity, they're talking about a range of differences in individual brain function and behavioral traits. So these can include how people socialize, how they learn, how they pay attention, their mood, and other mental functions. Okay, this is the big thing. And it's in non-pathological ways that are regarded as part of a normal variation in the human population. So I'm not sure how much this audience or any audience really would be familiar with the whole territory and conversation between neurodiversity and the disability movement. They are two separate things, so there is overlap. And typically in neurodiversity, I should say typically, but in a more narrow focus, it relates to people with autism, ADHD, and those living with learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. However, since the neurodiversity came onto the scene and was defined, it has started to apply to other neurodevelopmental disorders and can include even certain things that would be considered mental health issues, such as schizoaffective disorder, sometimes OCD, sometimes personality disorders, because what it seeks to do is take a more social perspective. So it's not just a diagnosis that needs to be fixed and cured with medical intervention so that it never existed or so that you can then be
normal.
And neurotypical basically is about people who are non-autistic. They have non-autistic brains. Okay. Essentially, to keep it clear and focused, that's what neurotypical means, right?
Okay.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. And I looked that up, like neuroatypical, what the definition of that was.
Please.
And then, the definition was someone who's not neurotypical.
Yes.
Thanks for the circular definition.
Not helpful.
Okay. You know?
Just to say real quick, so neurodiversity was actually coined in 1998 by sociologists who also had autism.
Mm-hmm.
And her name, I think, is Judy Singer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really started to take root first in the autism movement. And then it has since been enlarged and expanded to include other things. But medical experts, neurodiversity advocates, people in the disability movement, everyone's got different nuanced understandings, explanation around that. But that's kind of the territory.
Well, I want to talk to you about using, when you said the word normal, Heather, you used air quotes. Mm-hmm. And so the difference between calling something neurotypical and calling something normal, mm-hmm. calling you neurodivergent versus atypical or even worse, mm-hmm. abnormal. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to the power of using phrases like that?
Like neurodiversity and neurotypical?
Yeah, versus normal and abnormal.
Yeah, and sometimes I throw in the normals just because if people haven't had any experience or exposure mm-hmm. to different brains and what that means, and that's a thing, normal and not normal is going to make more sense to them. So it's really okay. Like, what audience are we talking to?
Okay.
But the purpose of bringing in neurotypical, neurodiverse, is to be like, now these are parts of identity. They're parts of being and interacting and behaving in the world that need to be named, need to be talked about. Ideally, society would enlarge enough to be accessible to all brain differences.
Mm.
So it really sets up this conversation for people who are living with these differences to have more autonomy, more empowerment, sometimes with the use or other assists. So like mm-hmm. Independent living assisting or different, let's say, amount of time you have for a test mm-hmm. or different, I don't know, accommodations based on mm-hmm. where the rub of the neurotypical world is rubbing it against their neurodivergent difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
How do we negotiate
right.
that so
yeah.
everybody can have access?
We don't judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree.
No.
I was just going to say that out loud. I was going to.
Excellent.
Yes, because that's really what it is. It's kind of like people demanding, yes, that this fish climb a tree. Yeah,
one way.
Like, yeah, do this. And then, yeah, I run into so many people I had experiences in my life where people would say, like, why don't you – you're so gifted. You're so smart. And I talk about this on mm-hmm. other podcasts that I work on. But it's like, why, you're so gifted. How do you not understand this? And it's like, I don't understand why I don't understand. I mean, at least there was a time when I didn't understand why I didn't understand.
Huh.
You know, and people would get mad and they'd call me names. Mm. And I was about to say one, but I'm not going to – not right
yeah.
now. But, you know, and it was just not very respectful. And, you know, it comes up where – and I say this to people. It's like if I'm asking people to accept me for who I am or at least who it is that I'm supposed to be, I have to at least try and understand or accept those people for who they do believe they're supposed to be, if they mm-hmm. do believe they have a prejudice or if they do believe they have a discomfort or a rage for anything that's different or anyone that's different. I'm not saying I condone it. I'm not wow. in any way saying I condone
yeah.
it, but – it's like, as I tell our parents, I had to tell them this. To understand my condition, I had to understand the human condition.
Mm.
And the human condition is that we don't – some of us do not understand, nor do they want to.
Mm.
You know? And it's like – so I'm not going to sit there and try and just hammer something into people like terms and
sure.
you know, it's like – because they'll just be like, whatever. You know? So
yeah.
what I'm going to do is just make a difference.
Mm. Well, I wonder about this concept of being well adapted to a sick world is not really a metric for health.
No.
But you're living in a world where, Heather, I have known you to just fight passionately for access to the medication that you want, for treatment that you need, for counselors that can identify with you. John, you said you didn't get your diagnosis until you were 30.
Yeah.
And so I just want to talk to each of you about what would be the best advice that you would have for how to advocate for yourself as a patient. Heather, you can go ahead and go first.
And you can jump in because I think some of this may overlap.
Sure.
I know for me, from my brain, like, again, for, let's say, my ADHD brain, I need to see things. I need to experience them. I need to be engaged in order for things to stick in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to go find people who have things I think I might have and read about their experiences. So go find all the autobiographies of people who are living with ADHD or anxiety and depression. Go find it on NAMI.org, which is a website that's dedicated primarily to mental health conditions. I also go and look for different online groups listen to different mm-hmm. podcasts, really work on educating myself, because unfortunately, as I'm sure you've experienced, you know, we live in a smaller area. Mm-hmm. There are people who are either self-described experts on either autism or ADHD that it turns out not to be the case, yeah. or it turns out that they're lacking key components either because they don't live with it themselves, they haven't studied it extensively, or are new to their journey to understanding. Mm-hmm. And so there really is a lot of self-advocacy required. And the challenge is that for people who have certain levels of impairments, that self-advocacy is not possible. They do need assistance to get mm-hmm. that, and sometimes they'll get that, and sometimes they won't. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make that aware. Like, I am able to advocate a lot for myself, but I have resources. Mm-hmm. I have economic and social resources. I have time. I can hold a day job. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to advocate for myself in certain ways, but you know, when I sit at the table and I beat my fist on the bench, yeah. sometimes it would just be nice if in every situation I come to, even with, medical professionals, yeah. I didn't have to explain everything or really fight to be seen, heard, listened to, understood, because how could you have problems? You look normal, in quotes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You look healthy.
Yeah. You've got great skin. Beautiful
right?
hair.
So how can I be like, no, I'm really struggling with some executive functioning deficits. I'm really struggling with some mood issues. Hmm. I'm willing to do the work. How can I get support for this? Right. You know?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. So advocating, right, for
yeah.
ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just started talking. It's not like I hadn't been talking, okay, before a certain time or a certain mm-hmm. instance or something like that. But I was talking to a specialist, and this specialist, because I had been trying to figure out, okay, why is it that I don't understand the world the way that other people do? You know, why is it that I don't understand that that's a joke? Why don't I understand, you know, unless I'm told it's a joke, like verbally, why don't I understand that there's a joke? Why don't I understand, you know, how something has changed,
yeah.
you know, or that something was going to change, you know? Why am I not understanding that, you know? The way other people do, and why are people needing to point out to me that I don't understand that? You know, and that was really the beginning of my journey, or my sort of, I guess, quest, or my trek. I better stop there. I was just trying to think of synonyms. I start to do that as soon as I think of a word. I start to envision, or
Well, repetition is helpful for mm-hmm. self-soothing.
Yes, yes, it can be. You know, but for me, I just do it, I suppose, creatively, you know, because I know those words. I start to say them. You know? And that's one of the ways people would say, like, why do you do that? You know, like, why do you need to? And it's like, it's not a need. I just start because there are so many. You know, it's like, let's say them. You know? And then people are like, but you don't have to. You know?
Huh.
So, I was asking so many questions of counselors and doctors and clinicians and professionals, and I found a specialist who just had me talk and just say, start talking. You know, tell me about this. Tell me about it. And so that's my advice. To answer the question, how do you advocate for yourself? Just start talking. And if people tell you to be quiet, keep talking. Okay? Keep trying to figure out, like, keep processing out loud. Keep, speaking. Keep declaring. Keep being vocal about what it is that you see, what it is that you hear, you know, what it is that's going on.
And, John, just to add to what you're saying is, you know, we talk a lot about self and like, how do we have a self and your experience of the self. And then in our most recent, we started season three, your phrase that you said is, I need a we to be me.
Yeah. Being a communitarian. Me needs a we to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that ties into talking and engaging and whatnot. Is that a way so you have that reflection of what your self is, or can you speak more to that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and that's how I did find out who I am, because people would tell me, oh, you're this sort of person. Oh, really? You know, it's like, and literally, like, I will walk past mirrors and I'll like startle myself. Like, whoa, like that. I don't retain what I look like.
Whoa.
You know, or what I sound like. And that's how far, I guess, my brain is going. Not. And it's not like it's hiding or I haven't been traumatized as far as I know. It's just it doesn't have that. I had said that the relationship that part of my brain has to another part of my brain is complicated. They're not speaking to one another. You know, but and that's something that occurs. And so how do I advocate for myself when I don't have a sense of self? And so that's – I just do it. you know, I don't know how to feel embarrassed. I don't know how to feel nervous. I don't know how to feel, at least in a typical way, if it's even there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But this specialist had said, just talk, you know, and it's like, and something that I hold on to too, and I do teach this in classes, is like, rarely do what you want, often do what you can, always do what you must, you know? And so I must talk about this. I must let people know, because there are some people who cannot talk about this the way I can, you know, who are nonverbal or they don't understand you know, yet that they can say something.
Well, you handed me a bracelet in the beginning of the conversation, and it says, never stop learning. And in the spirit of that, I just want to encourage people to check out the web series and the podcast. The web series is on YouTube. The podcast is on Spotify. It's called Where Are You From? We've been visiting with the co-hosts of the program, John David Berdahl and Heather Zinger. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ashley.
Still to come on Main Street, climate change and its impact on your health. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's Senate Majority Leader says lawmakers will be back November 8th to deal primarily with two big subjects. One is redistricting. The other is spending the $1 billion from the American Rescue Plan Act. Dickinson Republican Rich Wardner says the Interim Redistricting Committee is putting the final touches on its plan, and the House and Senate Appropriations Committees will hold hearings before the session on the ARPA money. He says that means two bills will be ready.
There will be the redistricting bill, there will be the appropriations bill, and then there will be more hearings on that appropriations bill. So people will get two or three cracks at it before it's finally passed by the full assembly.
Wardner says doing it this way will mean a short session that could be done in 5 to 8 days. He says if lawmakers have ideas for other issues to be considered, those would have to come through the delayed bills committee.
I would say the rule of thumb will be, if it's something that can wait until next session, we're not going to allow it during this special session.
But Wardner says if it is an urgent issue, it could be considered. And North Dakota has had nearly 18,000 job openings in recent months, with roughly 1,000 in construction. A labor leader in the trades says federal legislation to boost infrastructure and social programs could help fill open positions now and in the future. From the already approved American Rescue Plan to the current Build Back Better proposal and the separate infrastructure bill, supporters say the investments could pay off in a variety of ways. Jason Ellert is with North Dakota's Building Trades Unions. He says there are opportunities to boost recruitment and training that might appeal to younger generations.
We're trying to make that link between there is education in construction. You're just not going to go to work every day, day in and day out, and just be kind of that grunt, that there's education involved with the trades.
As for plans being debated, the infrastructure bill has bipartisan support, but the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan faces pushback from GOP lawmakers and business groups who say it's too costly and could harm the economic rebound from the pandemic. But Ellert says the budget reconciliation package addresses gaps in what he calls wraparound services for industries such as construction. For example, he says bigger investments in child care could allow more females to enter and stay in the field.
We still always continually work from like that 7 to 4:30 work day. And if you don't have that child care option, construction is not going to be a viable career pathway.
Ellert says focusing on training can set new hires up for long-term success while reducing safety risks as they start their construction careers. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to continue the topic of health today, but explore it from the idea of climate change. Bill McKibben is an environmentalist and an author and a climate change activist. He's written more than a dozen books. The most recent is called Falter, and his seminal 1989 text is The End of Nature. Both of these explore the deadly link between climate change and our health. He spoke with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, the hosts of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast.
Bill, we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare today.
Well, Margaret, Mark, what a pleasure to get to join you both in this community that you've created.
Well, thanks so much, Bill. And as you say, we're between a rock and a hot place, and we're witnessing the climate crisis play out in real time, back-to-back hurricanes devastating entire regions. We have mega droughts, massive wildfires, all happening simultaneously in this country. And against that backdrop, Congress is back in Washington, taking up President Biden's $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, which includes the most significant climate change legislation ever considered. What's so groundbreaking about this legislation?
Well, the first thing that's so novel about it, Mark, is simply that it exists. The U.S. Congress has known about climate change for 30 years, and they've done zero, zilch. We've never passed real climate legislation. The closest we came was in 2009, when there was something called cap and trade, and it never even reached a vote in the U.S. Senate. So this would be novel simply by its existence. But beyond that, it's really the first piece of legislation that even begins to address climate change at something like the scale of the problem. We've delayed so long now, and things have gotten so far out of control that it's going to take a real effort. And this is a down payment on that effort anyway, and hopefully enough to really start jumpstarting the transition to renewable energy that we desperately need.
Well, Bill, you noticed in a recent article that it's not the heat, it's the humanity, which I really appreciated, and say that climate change and pollution cause an estimated 5 million global deaths per year. But the scientists say global warming poses a far greater risk to human health than the pandemics. I keep having in my mind an image of the doomsday clock, you know, that we used to look at around the potential for nuclear wars, but climate change now being right up there on the doomsday clock. What's the true cost to human health that we're seeing even today?
This is such an interesting question, Margaret, because you can answer it in two ways. One, there's a big cost to human health when you have endless series of fires, floods, storms, and an endless increase in the number of people on the move around the world because the place where they lived for generations right. No longer sustains life. I mean, we're seeing even in the most rich parts of the entire world. I mean, in Manhattan, people were drowning in basement apartments when the remnants of Hurricane Ida swept through. So you can imagine what the toll is like in the poorest parts of the world. Is that the thing that causes climate change, fossil fuels, burning coal, oil, and gas, also kills people quite directly. The pollution that's produced when it's combusted, not the carbon dioxide that doesn't really do much to us directly, but the carbon monoxide and the particulates and the other forms of pollution that come when you burn fossil fuel. There was a study this year indicating that it's killing about 8.7 million people a year, more than HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. It's about one death in five on this planet. So getting rid of fossil fuel not only helps us ward off the very worst of climate change and the death toll that comes with it, it also has immediate payoffs in terms of human health just from what we're breathing every day. There's no reason not to do it now. The scientists and engineers have worked their miracles, and wind power and solar power are now the cheapest forms of power on planet Earth. In a rational world, we would be devoting all our energy to spreading that miracle just as fast as we could.
Bill, I want to pick up on the thread that you identified, that really the vulnerable population all across the globe is being impacted. And we see it play out here right in our own organization, a community health center. How do we leverage our healthcare delivery and our public health systems to mitigate, I would say even prevent, the worst harm of climate change? Is there a greater role for the healthcare industry to play?
Yes, of course. One of the things that the pandemic should have taught us, I think, I mean, there were a bunch of things, like physical reality is real, so take it seriously. But clearly one of the most important is that solidarity really matters, that we need to be taking care of each other in serious ways. You know, the three of us have kind of grown up under the political shadow of Ronald Reagan, who convinced a generation of Americans that government was the problem, not the solution. You know, the laugh line in his speeches was always, the nine scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Right.
But it turns out the scariest words are things like, we've run out of ventilators, or the hillside behind your house just caught on fire. And you don't solve those things with market solutions. You solve them with people working together and to solve problems. And so we're at one of those moments, and this is really reflected in this $3.5 trillion bill that the Biden administration is putting forward, because part of it is devoted to infrastructure of the kind that, you know, the solar panels, the electric car chargers that we need to deal with the climate crisis. But another large part of it is directed at what's called human infrastructure, at the education and healthcare policies that allow us to build a society that's stable, equitable, resilient enough to begin to handle what's coming at it. And one without the other does not make sense.
You know, I want to congratulate you for spearheading one of the largest divestiture campaigns in modern history, with Harvard being the latest institution to divest fossil fuels from its portfolio. What do you think this kind of economic strategy is going to do in terms of exerting pressure on the fossil fuel industry? Will things be different?
Well, the reason we undertook this divestment campaign, which has become the largest anti-corporate campaign perhaps in history, we're at about $15 trillion now in portfolios and endowments that have divested. The reason we undertook it is because the fossil fuel industry has been a malign force on this planet. They have orchestrated a 30-year scheme of denial and disinformation that kept us locked in a completely sterile debate about whether or not global warming was real, a debate we now know from great investigative reporting that both sides, the fossil fuel industry and scientists, knew the answer to back when it began. It's just one of those sides was willing to lie. And that lie has cost us 30 years that we are never getting back. Unlike other public policy issues, it's a timed test. If we don't get it right now, then there's no chance anyone in the future will. Once you melt the Arctic, no one's got a plan to refreeze it. And it's the fossil fuel industry that has cost us that time and that continues to try and delay. So any strategy that weakens their financial and political standing is helpful in advancing the rational work that scientists, engineers are doing to point us in a new direction. Their willingness to hold on to their business model, even at the cost of breaking the planet, probably puts even the tobacco industry in the shade as the single worst example of corporate malfeasance of all time. So that's why that divestment movement has now gotten not just Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge and the University of California behind it, but also even the Pope and the Queen of England have come out for divestment. You know, short of getting Beyonce on board, I don't know what else we're supposed to do at this point.
We're speaking today with Bill McKibben, a writer, environmentalist, and renowned climate activist. He's the author of a dozen books on climate change, including The End of Nature and more recently, Falter. You know, Bill, we withdrew from the Paris Climate Accord. We left the WHO. The UN recently released a report stating, without a doubt, climate change is indeed man-made and immediate action is required. How do we organize in a collective way to meet these persistent challenges of climate change? You've talked about one initiative, which is investing in alternatives to fossil fuel. But what other ways can you lay out that we might organize?
Superb question, Mark. The two good things that have happened in the last decade are, one, that scientists and engineers have dropped the cost of renewable energy 90%. And the other is that these big global movements have arisen to demand change. I got to work on sort of the first iteration of that when we formed 350.org about a decade ago. And it's gone on to organize in every country on Earth except North Korea. Now there are people flooding into this area. So we have in Europe, Extinction Rebellion. We have the wonderful post-college students from the Sunrise Movement who have brought us the Green New Deal. And we have, most beautifully and movingly, I think, the high school and junior high school students who probably are the most active of all. Everybody knows about Greta Thunberg, and they should. She's wonderful. But she would be the first to say that the best news is there are 10,000 Greta Thunbergs, and they have 10 million followers demanding that we pay attention to their future. So those kind of movements are crucial. The most important thing an individual can do is be less of an individual, to join together with others in movements large enough to change the political and economic ground rules. And so that's why for those of us who aren't so young, those of us who are over 60, we've just launched this new effort called thirdact.org that will allow experienced Americans to play their part supporting young people in this fight. These generations, many of us had a pretty good first act. We were witness to or participant in some profound cultural and political transformations, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. Perhaps our second act, taken as a whole, was more devoted to being consumers than citizens, but we've now emerged in our third act with lots of skills, more than our share of resources, and some grandkids, and hence real reason not to want to leave the world a worse place than we found it, which is going to be our legacy. We're going to be the first generation that can carry that curse unless we get our act together very quickly. I think the real problem is that climate change seems so large and we seem so small in comparison that it becomes hard for us to imagine that we can make a real difference. And that's why I think the key word that some people use is agency, the sense that we have the power to make a difference. We only have it when we come together. People find it not just powerful, they find it an extraordinary relief, including psychologically, to be engaged in this fight. Now, we do not know how this fight's going to come out, you know, and that's different from other causes that we've been engaged in. Dr. King used to say at the end of speeches, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Yeah. That was a comforting words for the brave people in the civil rights movement. What it meant was, this may take a while, but we're going to win. Well, Mark, the arc of the physical universe is short, and it bends toward heat. If we don't win soon, then we never win. And that's why, you know, that's why some of us end up going to jail, which is seems crazy, but it's what it's taken often to get these things done. Not everybody has to go to jail, but everybody has to be outside their comfort zone, because the planet is outside its comfort zone. What we're doing so far is not enough, and so we need to step up our game.
You know, we've had a frontline seat, all of us, on the COVID pandemic as we saw it descend in our communities and engaged in many conversations with people in general in the communities, and realized there are quite a few deniers out there about the reality of COVID, the impact of COVID. And when we think about climate, the climate deniers too. But it would be hard to have watched the news over the last 4 to 6 weeks and not at least allow for the possibility that something really bad was going on here. Is there a shift beginning to this being more commonly accepted that this is real and we need to do something about it?
Yes, over the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a decisive shift, Margaret. And the polling now shows that 70% of Americans understand that we face a real dilemma with climate change.
70%, that's great.
In a country, 70%, in a country as polarized as ours, 70% is good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, their deniers remain, but they're not going to change because their beliefs aren't rooted in science. They're just rooted in ideology. And if you'd spent the last, you know, 30 years, you know, marinating yourself in Rush Limbaugh, you wouldn't be able to think clearly about this kind of stuff either. I mean, you know, ideology is a dangerous drug sometimes. It gets in the way of reality. But the problem is not deniers. The problem is that of that 70%, not enough people are active in this fight. We've got to take some percentage of those people and turn them into real battlers. And COVID is instructive here. I think we're doing better as time goes on that fight. One difference is, happily, there's no trillion-dollar industry that wants us all to die from COVID, you know. Sadly, there is a trillion-dollar industry that wants us to keep our current energy business model intact. And that's why it's been taken us 30 years to overcome the disinformation schemes of the fossil fuel industry, but we're getting there. The only thing that worries me is time. The scientists have told us, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in their last report said that we had until 2030 to have emissions, cut emissions in half around the globe, or we would not be able to reach the targets we set in Paris just 5 or 6 years ago. 2030 is now 8 years and change away. We're all experienced enough to know that our systems are not geared for rapid change. So we're going to have to gear them for rapid change. That's our job, to force the spring here.
You know, let me pull a question on the Paris Climate Accord. Candidate Joe Biden said that the first act that he would do, one of the first acts, was to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, which he saw as a paramount step really to address global climate change. But activists like yourself say more must be done. Tell us what the strengths and weaknesses of the Paris Accord are, so people can have a broader view.
Even when we signed the Paris Climate Accords, we knew, and the President Obama said at the time, that it wasn't strong enough. Even if we met all the promises in the Paris Climate Accords that countries made, the temperature would still rise about 3 degrees Celsius, so 5-6 degrees Fahrenheit, which is too much. We can't deal with that. And that's why everybody is aimed at strengthening the ambition of countries. And the crucial meeting is in November in Glasgow, the most important climate meeting at least since Paris. John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, is now our climate envoy, demonstrating, I think, how seriously the Biden administration has taken this. And he needs to be able to go to Glasgow to negotiate with something in his pocket. That something is that $3.5 trillion bill before the U.S. Senate. If it passes, then he'll be able to say with a straight face, the U.S. has begun to commit serious resources to this fight. We're moving up our timetable. China, India, we need you to move up yours. If he goes there with nothing in his pocket, then that's not going to be a productive meeting. And that 8 years is suddenly going to seem even shorter than it seems now.
We've been speaking today with Bill McKibben, environmentalist, author, and renowned climate change activist. You can learn more about his groundbreaking work by going to BillMcKibben.com, and I'm going to spell it M-C-K-I-B-B-E-N, or follow him on Twitter at Bill McKibben. And thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, I've enjoyed it enormously, and thanks to both of you for your leadership, especially your leadership in building this informed community. That's what it takes.
That was author and environmentalist Bill McKibben speaking with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. It's produced by the Community Health Center of Connecticut. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly, co-host of All Things Considered. We are celebrating some big milestones this year, NPR's 50th year of changing the landscape of radio journalism and non-commercial programming, and 4 decades of Prairie Public telling North Dakota's fascinating stories. You have the energy sector, a thriving technology and entrepreneurial sector, lots of agriculture, not to mention some pretty intense weather in your part of the world. It is a vast, beautiful place to be. Well, we are honored to help you feel a little more connected to everywhere else with NPR journalists, their unrivaled skill and passion, bringing you closer to the news and sounds and people of the nation and the world. Prairie Public's Dave Thompson and his team of reporters, they have got the regional angle expertly covered. Now, here's how you can help keep the symbiotic relationship going strong. Become a sustaining member of Prairie Public by going to prairiepublic.org, or you can call 800-359-4145. Happy 40th, Prairie Public, happy 50th, NPR, and happy, we hope, first day of your brand new membership.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 21st. The 1950s are remembered fondly by most U.S. history textbooks. Known as the Eisenhower era, the post-war years were considered a new height of prosperity, with median family purchasing power increasing as much as 30%. Unfortunately, that prosperity was not universally shared. While many Americans were celebrating the end of World War II, Indigenous people on the Fort Berthold Reservation were being forced into a settlement agreement over losses they would suffer due to the Garrison Dam. After this settlement, they experienced an economic decline aggravated by drought, poor relationships with the surrounding governments, and their decreasing ownership of the land. The reservation continued to struggle until JFK championed 2 important pieces of federal legislation that had long-term effects. The first was the Area Redevelopment Act in 1961. This act allotted $450 million over 4 years for vocational training programs.
It was meant to help in regions with severe, unemployed, and underemployed people, with reservations eligible for the assistance. The other important legislation was the Manpower Development and Training Act in 1962. This act helped educate people on new skills as older skills were becoming obsolete. This included a 12-person construction carpentry program. The men who trained in these classes worked on many projects, including new high schools for the reservation in White Shield, Mandaree, and Partial. They also helped build recreational facilities and a museum at Four Bears Park. These projects provided short-term employment, but they were followed by a massive low-rent housing effort that included projects in Newtown, Partial, Mandaree, Twin Buttes, and White Shield. On this date in 1967, the Newtown News reported that the projects were ahead of schedule, with prospective tenants being chosen from a long list of applicants. Another longer-term project was developing Four Bears Park into a major recreation center. This project took 4 years and employed 23 tribal members. Together, the Area Redevelopment Act and the Manpower Development and Training Act not only helped relieve the tribe's economic struggles, they also provided buildings that would serve the reservation for years to come. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, my name is Daniel Bean, and I am from Botno, North Dakota. I listen to Prairie Public every morning and every afternoon when I drive from Botno to the Turtle Mountain Reservation, where I teach high school. And being a history teacher and particularly liking local history, I found Dakota Datebook to be a very intriguing and enlightening and educational program. I started using Dakota Datebook in my North Dakota Studies class when I first started teaching in 2016 and saw it as an excellent way to inform my students about history that they're never ever going to hear otherwise. I tend to be more conservative in my political views, but one of the things I like about Prairie Public, particularly the news program and NPR, is that they give me a balance, and I value that. I look forward to listening to Main Street every afternoon because it tells me things about everyday life in North Dakota, from celebrations, festivals, news.
For all the reasons you listen, become a sustaining member of Prairie Public. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the red link that says donate.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki. Okay, if you're on a first name basis with all of those people, you listen to a lot of NPR. We hear the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.